It's wonderful to see everybody here. I realize the special sacrifice you make to come on a Friday afternoon. I really appreciate you being here. Barbara, you and Bob O'Neill have done such a wonderful job with the Abraham Lecture over the years, and I've been in the audience many a time, and there's just a very distinguished group of folks that you've invited here. And I really appreciate the way in which you've made this lectureship a fitting honor to our friend Hemery. Also, really pleased to see Dean John Jeffries of the University of Virginia Law School here in the audience. He's been a friend of mine for 40 years. And I just want to say what a magnificent dean of this law school he has been, and I'm honored to be his friend. Henry, your writings on the court are unsurpassed in their wisdom and their eloquence and their erudition. And each spring I look forward to this gathering of your friends and your colleagues, and devoted students, just to tell you how much you mean to all of us. And you and Mildred are certainly one of Charlottesville's first and finest couples. And we have been touched over the years at various occasions, including those wonderful birthday parties that Mildred throws for you. We've been touched by your warmth and your personal magnanimity as a couple. And it's an honor to give this lecture in your name. I've become, over the years, my talks have become a little bit less prepared and a little bit more sort of extemporaneous, and I want to try to adopt a bit of a conversational tone when we talk about the questions that come to me about the federal judiciary. I realize that there are a number of lawyers in the audience, but also a great many non-lawyers, mercifully. and I hope I might have something of interest to say to both. I just thought as a theme for the talk that I would take up some questions that are most frequently asked me about life on the federal bench. This is a good chance to try to think through and to provide some answers. One of the questions that's asked me most frequently are, what was the greatest surprise that you encountered when you became a federal judge? And I guess the greatest surprises are, to me, the cases that I've had to sit on involving problems that I'd never possibly anticipated. I've been on the bench now for 24 years, and I think back to the time of my confirmation that I never dreamed of the impact that the internet would have, or how much litigation, the internet-related litigation, would surface. We spent an awful lot of time trying to adapt traditional principles of law in the area of libel and slander and trademark infringement and personal jurisdiction to this extraordinary new world. You could have knocked me over with a feather at the time of my confirmation if you'd said, well, you're going to have to deal with a lot of cases involving the internet. In 1984, we never dreamed of the dimension of the AIDS epidemic. That's generated a good many cases as to how the Americans with Disabilities Act applies to AIDS and the extent to which AIDS in different stages should be treated as a disability under that statute. In 1984, that was unknown. And of course, who could have anticipated 9/11 and the cases of first impression that would have that arose from that horrible day. So I guess my biggest surprise is that I encountered a world that I never dreamed of. At the time that I went on the bench, and problems that I never could have foreseen. And some of the people that are up before the United States Senate today will be serving in as late as 2030 or 2040. And we can take an educated guess as to what they will be dealing with in the future. We can say, well, they'll be dealing with the shortages and dislocations brought about by global warming, and interpreting Congress's efforts to deal with that. And we'll be dealing with the cases that may arise out of some unforeseen pandemic. We'll certainly be dealing with bioethical issues, where we try to capture all the great benefits of scientific progress, and yet at the same time, I hope, are wary of the profound dangers that come with tampering with genetic materials and the sort of basic building blocks of our very beings and the universe. And we can foresee all kinds of things that may be over the horizon, but even guessing about bioethics and pandemic and global warming, we're really going to miss so much. We're not going to be able to tell what those judges in 2030 are going to be grappling with. And what does this suggest? And again, my friend Dean Jeffries has touched on this earlier in an article, but it suggests that when we follow judicial confirmation proceedings, we not try to put an excessive emphasis upon litmus tests and upon responses to a specific issue that dominates the headlines during the present day. You may be pro-life on abortion, you may be pro-choice, or you may be somewhere in between. And whatever your position is, I certainly respect it. And I don't mean to downgrade the importance of the issue, but abortion should not be a litmus test for whom we want as a federal judge, and nor should any other single issue. What you're looking for is somebody who's going to take unforeseen and unanticipated problems and hopefully have the character and the temperament and the balance and the seasoning to deal with things we know not of. And sometimes I think that these confirmation battles in Congress, if they suffer from one thing, is that they suffer from maybe two, contemporary, a perspective. I'm asked a lot, well, what are the big cases that you've decided? And my response to that is, there are no big cases. There are no little cases. They're just cases that matter to you. And if I can draw an analogy to the field of medicine, sometimes physicians, especially academic physicians, get very excited over complicated medical problems. A disease that's very rare, or a disease with all sorts of dimensions and complications and mysteries and the rest involved in it. And those may be the diseases that end up in the professor's slideshow in medical school. And similarly, judges and lawyers get all wound up about cases that are intellectually fascinating and cases that draw big public attention. And what I would suggest to you is that there may be a basic disconnect between the fascination of the professions with the unusual and the intellectual challenging, and what our basic obligation is as public servants, which is to treat every person on an operating table or every person before the court with equal conscientiousness and dignity, I want to tell you a little story. Justice Powell, after he retired from the Supreme Court, came down, sat with the Fourth Circuit. And the first case he had was a Social Security disability case. The medical record was very detailed. There were no large issues of law involved. There was a history of disability, and the question of whether the person was disabled was a bit on the edge. And I was surprised as I heard Justice Powell ask questions from the bench just how familiar he was with the details of this person's medical history. And I got back into conference and I said, Justice Powell, you have decided cases that shook the nation on abortion and capital punishment and church-state relations and affirmative action and many other things. And I'm amazed that you took such an interest in this. And he said, well, it matters, doesn't it? And yes, it does. Everything matters. Those of us on the inside of institutions and bureaucracies need to understand the mindset and the wishes of those on the outside. When you deal with the Internal Revenue Service or the Division of Motor Vehicles, you know what means something to you to get a voice on the end of the phone? To have somebody not play a shell game with you? To have a prompt and courteous decision? So those of us on the inside of a court system need to think about the folks on the outside and not just take our own sweet time. People want prompt decisions, they want courtesy, they want us to agree, but that's not always going to happen. But what they can expect is some promptness and courtesy and conscientiousness, just the way we would like from the IRS and the DMV. Another thing people ask me about, they say, gee, as a judge, it must be a terribly monastic lifestyle. I think when my kids were growing up, they thought it was really boring. And sort of lamented the fact that I wasn't a firefighter or something and could tell them about the fires that I put out that day. And it is a little bit of a monastic lifestyle, being a judge. You don't participate at all in partisan politics. You don't get involved in campaigns. If you were to go by the courthouse parking lot, you wouldn't find any political bumper stickers. They're very refreshing. There's no fundraising. We can't be involved in that. You have to be careful in your relationship with lawyers. And I love to have dinner with my lawyer friends, but not if the case is anywhere near me. Try not to run too many red lights. Famous last words. I'll probably commit a traffic violation on the way home. Somebody breaks in line in front of you, go right ahead. As a judge, you do not want to create a scene. So is it monastic? Yes. I suppose the greatest symbol of judicial monasticism is those black robes we wear on the bench. Did you know that not all judicial robes are black? The Maryland Court of Appeals has red robes. They're really beautiful. Now, those of us with black robes envy them. So they say, that's the monasticism, that black robe. Why do you wear that thing? Is it to inspire awe on the part of people in the courtroom? I hope not. A sense of solemnity, yes. But awe, no. Is it to create distance between those on the bench and those in the audience? I hope not. I mean, what purposes do uniforms serve, be they black robes or the raiments of a minister, or the white coat of a physician, or the uniform of a baseball player? What purposes do these uniforms serve? Well, I can say as a judge that it's not to intimidate you, it's to help me. And I think every person that wears a uniform, whether it's a judge or a policeman or a minister or anybody else, might take the view that this uniform is not to puff that person up or to create a sense of hierarchy, but it's to help the person that wears it. In my case, it reminds me of the highest aspirations of the judicial profession and how, despite the many mistakes I may make, I'm going to stumble and get up and try to live up to what that black robe represents. And that's what I think any kind of garment represents. It's a call to the person who wears it. It's not an attempt to bully or intimidate or create distance with somebody else. And these monastic impositions, they're really not so bad. In fact, they come in handy. Before going on the bench, I used to do some fundraising. I didn't really like it. I found it very difficult to ask people for money, even in a really good cause. And after going on the bench, I'm ethically prohibited from even raising a dime for a lot of obvious reasons. You don't want a judge twisting your arm for money. So it's a relief when someone says, "Would you help us with fundraising for this or that enterprise?" And I say, "Oh, I'd love to." But I'm ethically forbidden. So what I'm saying is, don't feel too sorry for us. We choose it. Some folks have asked me, is the Supreme Court becoming more liberal or more conservative? People want to know that. That's a hard question to answer because the signals are always mixed. I think in the 1970s, the court, late 1960s and 70s, the court was pretty liberal by today's standards, much more liberal than the present court is in certain circumstances. In three cases, Dandridge v. Williams, Lindsay v. Normant, and the San Antonio versus Independent Rodriguez, it was a very active and strong and articulate liberal group, including one of the finest justices, nicest men that ever served on the Supreme Court, Justice Brennan. But they wanted to have a constitutional right to a certain level of public assistance and a constitutional right to a certain level of public housing and a constitutional right to a certain level of education. And of course, if you push that, then you're going to have to have, there's going to be a terrible temptation for the justice to say at what level those non-textual constitutional rights should be funded. If you go down that route, there's a grave danger that the judiciary will take over the basic function of the political process, which is to decide who gets and who pays. And the court in the late 1960s and 1970s had justices that were anxious, I think, to broaden access to the courts through habeas corpus, and several justices were willing to strike down capital punishment as an absolute matter, as in violation of the Eighth Amendment. And you don't have anywhere near that degree of domestic interventionism on the court today, and many of the battles are fought that used to be fought over constitutional law are now fought over statutory interpretation, which is a terribly important battleground, but a somewhat narrower one than the constitutional differences that prevailed in the 60s and 70s. The court, even in the halcyon days of the Warren Court, The Supreme Court was very reluctant to intervene in the Vietnam War, as unpopular as that war was. Even the more liberal justices, by and large, resisted the invitations and temptations to interfere with the conduct of foreign wars. And I think, by and large, the court today, whatever may be the feelings of the individual justices on the matter of Iraq, they haven't intervened in any basic way with the conduct of the Iraq war. The war on terror, the struggle against terrorism, is a little tougher kind of thing because it's a different kind of war. It's more prolonged, it's more shadowy, the enemy is more diffuse, and it's not going to end on the deck of an aircraft carrier off the coast of Japan with General Douglas MacArthur striding on deck to accept the Japanese offer of surrender. So it's the indefinite nature of this war that makes questions of detention and surveillance so very hard for the courts, and finding that particular balance in a war of indefinite duration has been, to understate the matter, a very challenging task. I don't think judges think, when we get on the bench, well, am I going to rule in a liberal or conservative fashion? We just rule case by case, and sort of the larger chips fall where they may, and it's up to others mainly to look at the overall direction. Our perspective is the individual case. I would say to you a couple things that make the judicial process very unique. One, we don't log roll cases. I have, as long as I've been on the bench, I've never seen log rolling where a judge said to another, well, I'll vote for you in this case if you'll vote for me in that case. That just doesn't happen. And imagine how unfair it would be to a litigant who has no control over what other cases are going through the process at the same time if judges were to log roll in that kind of fashion. So there's none of that horse trading and vote swapping in the judicial process that one would see in the political process, and that on occasion makes things move. The other thing, and I say this because I know it's on many people's minds, it's been my personal experience that the judicial process is not a partisan one. Media makes a lot over whether we were appointed by Republican presidents or Democratic presidents. And I know, to be honest, that there was a lot of skepticism after the Bush v. Gore decision, when the more conservative justices voted one way and the four liberal justices voted another way. All I can say to you is that it's good not to ascribe motives to people, and as a general matter, to give folks the benefit of good faith. And I have to tell you from my own experience that there are deep disagreements and deep philosophical disagreements on the court. But I honestly don't think that we're a partisan group. We take very seriously the obligation to set political partisanship aside when we go on the bench. And that's every judge with whom I serve. And I would hate to see skepticism about any one case contradict at least what I think most judges feel are lifetimes of experience with a process in which people are trying to do the best for the litigants before them. Now, I get lots and lots of questions about law clerks. Lots of them. In fact, people seem to be a lot more fascinated with law clerks than they are with about judges. And I'm really glad that some of my law clerks are here. I choose lots of law clerks from the University of Virginia because the university trains them so well. I have two of my law clerks, Elizabeth McGill and Barbara Armacost, who are on the faculty here, and a third, Leslie Kendrick, who's going to be joining the faculty next year, and they're all women of exceptional talent and capability. A couple of my law clerks are here today. Allie Orr, will you stand up? Please. And Paul Crane, will you stand up? And Dan Bress, where are you? Okay, there you are. Is Catherine Toomey here? Well, there she is. She's going to be my law clerk next year. Now, if you look at them all, you'll notice they have one thing in common. They're very, very young. And I'll tell you another little story about Justice Powell. I love Lewis Powell stories. He came on the Supreme Court, and he was a senior partner at Hunt and Williams, and he was 64 years old when he came on the Supreme Court. And he was stuck. I was a law clerk for him his first year, so he was stuck with four very young, green, junior people like me. And there was a case involving garnishment procedures. You know, when someone's wages are garnished by a creditor, could be an automobile dealer or a finance agency or something, and it garnishes the wages if the particular individual is behind in paying a particular debt. Well, back in the early 1970s, any lawyer worth a salt would have known the ins and outs of garnishment. And so I was sitting in there, and this case came up, and I said, Justice Powell, would you kind of, we didn't go over that a lot in the courses that I took, and I wonder if you'd explain to me what a garnishment procedure is. His jaw just dropped. He couldn't believe, after years of being a senior partner at Hunt and Williams and dealing with lawyers in their 40s and 50s with years of experience behind us, that he was saddled in being a Supreme Court justice with these three very junior, callow people. And so you look at these young folks today that just stood up and you say, what? This is all the assistance you have? How can you possibly get by? What in the world is this system? Does this system have to commend it? Well, you know, it has a lot to commend it. For one thing, I think our brightest young men and women learn a sense of respect for the judicial system. And it's great training for them when they go out in the world and become lawyers. And the other thing that's good about it is that the young law clerks which come on, they only stay with us for a single year as a rule. And this is a good thing because it prevents judges from becoming over-reliant on staff. And that can be a bit of a problem. Justice Louis Brandeis once said that the thing he loved about the Supreme Court is the justices did their own work. And I think that the constant turnover of law clerks means that you don't become overly reliant on staff. You have to keep on top of the issues yourself. But a great thing about the law clerks is that they bring a diversity of perspective. You know, we're in the habit of naming our generations, I guess. There's the X generation and the greatest generation, Tom Brokaw tells us, and I'm a part of the baby boomer generation. And then I'm told, aren't you lucky because your law clerks are going to be members of the millennial generation? That's quite a thing to be a member of the millennial generation. It means you only come along once in 1,000 years. Must be very special. But I do think that this generational mix is a very good thing. How can I live in the past with 4 young law clerks around me? And they can't get too futuristic or faddish because of me. And this difference in perspective is what the judicial process should try to aim for. I have a devotion to the academy. My background is as a professor and an academic to a considerable extent. And I remember when I sat once on a panel of 3 judges, and we went into conference to discuss the case we just heard, and I launched into some way up in the clouds, this is a very junior judge, very theoretical explanation, which might have impressed a very few of my colleagues at the coffee hour at the University of Virginia, but I was very proud of myself with this really, I thought, thoughtful, theoretical disquisition. So I propounded my view, and one of my colleagues looked at me after I had done this, about which I was so very proud, and he said, "Thank God there's only one academic on this court." And he's right. There's a great place for academics on the courts, but there's also a wonderful place for people who've been trial judges, understand what the trial process is like. There's also a great place on the courts for folks who've been in private practice. And I would hate to see a court without academics. I think it would be deprived of a very valuable perspective. But I'd also hate to see a court without trial judges and private practitioners. What we're looking for, and I think what produces good decisions, are people who come to the bench with different perspectives from one another. You gain a lot in this business just by listening. We all reflect on how we spend our lives. Or would you do it all over again? People say, sure, I would. I think everybody on the bench could have earned a great deal of money somewhere else. More money. 10 times what we're earning in our occupation on the bench. But I wouldn't trade my job for anything. Not for anything. As just a satisfaction at the end of the day in feeling that you've tried to help somebody out. Feeling that you've done the best you could. That's a good feeling to, when you put your head down on your pillow, it's a good feeling to drive home from work on. And any amount of money could ever replace that. And then this great society functions because we keep order and liberty in tension and balance. And it is such a privilege to me to be vindicating those liberties protected by the Bill of Rights, our great freedom of speech, freedoms protected, given to defendants in the criminal process. But it's also a real challenge to find the proper balance between liberty and between security, without which liberty cannot survive and flourish. Some people see liberty and security as in irreconcilable conflict. They are in conflict. The 20th century produced some terrible, terrible examples of dictators who can tell you what can happen to a society if it goes too far in the direction of security and entrusting too much to the powers of the state. But if you don't have a certain basic sense of security, a society turns inward on itself. People go forth less. They become fearful and suspicious of one another. They travel less. They engage in less commercial enterprise and risk-taking. So it's very important to have that basic level of security too. Liberty and security are not always in conflict. Sometimes they are, but in other times they're quite complementary. I want to just sort of end this on a bit of a personal note, if I may. While back, I was considered for the Supreme Court and had the opportunity to interview with a very fine man, President Bush, and for the job. And people ask me all the time, are you disappointed that you never made it to the Supreme Court? And yes. Of course. If I told you anything different, I wouldn't be telling the truth. I gave it everything I could within the limits of my principles, staying true to myself, and it didn't work out. And for a little while, I really felt very sorry for myself. And sometimes, feeling sorry for yourself is very justified. And sometimes feeling sorry for yourself can really be quite a bit of fun. It's fun and soothing in a certain way to feel underappreciated, misunderstood, the way you once did when your parents sent you up to your room. So I felt sorry for myself for a little while. And everybody has a right to feel sorry for themselves for a little while. But not indefinitely. And I looked at myself in the mirror one day and I said, Jay, you make a hell of a poor victim. So you got the best family and friends in the world. You got a community in Charlottesville that you love so much. You got a job that challenges you. Life has been bountiful. This country has been bountiful to you beyond measure. What more could you possibly ask or want? And there's a little poem, and I really kind of wish I knew who wrote it, but it appears in a lot of the anthologies, and it's only titled by Anonymous. But the poem has always meant a lot to me. And the poem reads as follows. It says, laugh and the world laughs with you. Weep and you weep alone. For the brave old earth lacks joy and mirth, but has sorrow enough of its own. And that's a great way to live. To just laugh and have the world laugh with you. And I'll tell you one thing that's made me feel mighty good about things, and that is that Chief Justice Roberts and Justice Alito were simply wonderful choices. And so you feel good if the profession of which you're a part is well served by a president's decision. And I just feel in his two choices that President Bush chose two of the very best people there were. And knowing and seeing people of that splendid caliber on the Supreme Court has made me feel mighty good about things. So, what's not to like? It's Friday afternoon in Charlottesville. And we're on the edge of an absolutely beautiful weekend. We're here among the dogwood and in the company of friends. And I appreciate so much your coming here and Barbara, you and Bob, giving me the chance to speak in honor of my friend Henry. I'm going to have a slip of the tongue one of these days and call him Justice Abraham. He's such a distinguished student and commentator on the court that he merits that appellation. Henry, thank you again for everything you've meant to your students, to this university, to the Supreme Court, to your wonderful family, to your friends. It's such an honor to give a lecture in your name. Thank you so much.